Good to see everyone who came back out this evening to be with us. And if you're visiting with us, we're certainly glad you're here. We want you to come back and be with us at every opportunity you have. Tonight's lesson, you might have noticed, might have gathered, especially if you picked up an outline. And if you've, by chance, gone to the website and actually checked out or looked at the first lesson that's on the website as correspondence course, so to speak, an online correspondence course, you might have noticed a lot of similarities between the two, and that's intentional. I'm going to talk about, over the next few months, probably do a lesson here and there, in which I'll go through the material that I'm including in the lessons online. That way you'll have an idea of where I'm going with those studies, especially if you direct someone to the site. And you can kind of get an idea of what I'll be doing in the course of those lessons. And if whether it's by correspondence course or if it's actually face-to-face study, the material will be the same, even though obviously if I'm doing it online with someone face-to-face or if I'm sitting down and studying with someone across the table, be able to go in more in-depth on each of these points, you understand that, than the correspondence course. Now, having said all of that, it's an interesting study in itself to look at what is popularly called the history of the church, and I'm by no means going to look at all of that because we'd start back on the day of Pentecost and we'd go through the centuries and look at where, as far as the world would be concerned, the development of the church, from the first century. I'm not going to do that. I'm more going to look at the history of the church really in the United States. And when I study with someone, sometimes starting off like this leads us into questions where indeed go back and kind of look at religion all through the centuries. But especially, it is interesting for people sometimes to see sort of, the history of thought, religious thought within this country. The various type churches you have, people realize if they familiarize themselves to any degree, they realize there are different kinds of churches, quote unquote. Some of them are very formal and a lot of religious rite. If you flip through the channels this weekend, you might have seen a lot of that associated with Easter, the broadcasting of certain Catholic church services, etc., from around the world. And that ranges all the way from that all the way to the very informal, more emotional, charismatic type religion. So people question that. They look at the difference. They wonder why, if all of these people are serving the same God or the same Savior, Jesus in particular, why would there be such difference? There are reasons for that. And it is interesting to see where our nation, just as a general rule, that doesn't mean everybody's involved in this by any means, but what stands out in different ages, it is interesting to see where the church has been. It's also interesting to see what is left over from that. And I'll mention that along the way as we go through the lesson tonight. So let's just kind of go back and start. And if you're looking at the church in this country, you might start with the, especially the Catholic missionaries, excuse me, I may have to do that a couple of times, but you might look at the Catholic missionaries of, say, the 1500s, but I'm not really going to do that. I want to start more with the idea of the pilgrims in the 1600s, and that's what's really affected the religious thought in general of our nation. Most people, by far, having, and I realize that may be different in this area, but most people by far throughout the country having a more Protestant tradition, and that would trace back in its beginning to the pilgrims and the Puritans and the congregational churches, which as you go up into New England, you still see quite a few of them there. They were very closely connected, as it were, with the Catholic Church, from all practical standpoints, they really were a Catholic church with a different head. But let's go back to that. And what you do when you look at that, if you look at the Puritans, the congregational churches, or you look at the Catholics, or you look at maybe Scottish Presbyterians and those traditions, you look at a very high church society mentality. Now, this is reflected in the worship. It's reflected a lot of times in the very building. It's the cathedrals as opposed to the, say, like ours, a very functional building. But you see the cathedrals. You see in the worship a lot of religious rites and so forth. High church reflected in the songs that are sung. There's de-emphasis of the spiritual. There is emphasis on a very stately, a very staid mannerism and so forth. All of that kind of thing. And if one comes from that background, or when one, if one looks at that period of history, there was a very legalistic attitude, a very restrictive attitude associated with it. Classically, people will look at the Puritans. They will look at the community that reflected the church. The civil laws reflected the church laws. In fact, in many respects, they were one and the same. There was this restrictive, there was this legalistic attitude. There was an emphasis on formality. There was a resistance to what they would have called modernization. And that's hard for us to think of 1600s as modern, but they would have looked at some of the ideas, the thoughts that just by coming to America or having come from Holland was very modern in its approach, and they resisted all of that. And so there was that approach to religion. And that has remained to a degree. You even find that in the Lord's church sometimes, that very same idea. That is the legalistic attitude, the restrictive attitude, the resistance to modernization, etc., etc. Now let's make a couple of observations. I mean, we can go on and on with that, but I don't want to do this with any point. Let's make a couple of observations. First of all, let's remind ourselves that something, and I want you to listen carefully to this statement, because it might sound wrong when it comes out of my mouth. Something is neither right or wrong based on the fact that it's old or new. Something is neither right or wrong based on the fact simply that it's old or new. Or let me put that in very simple terms. Something is not right just because it's how it, quote, has always been done. What tends to happen among people, religious people, we can see it in the Bible, and we can see it today. There is at times a tradition that is developed, and people get it in their minds that it is the only way something can be done. I'll tell you a little side story. This won't take long. When I became a member of the church, I attended one congregation naturally for a few months there. I knew nothing. Didn't know anything from the Bible, virtually nothing. Everything was brand new. I walked in. I became a member, obviously. I began to observe what we did. Now, when I went away to college for the first time and went to a different congregation, we didn't do the same order. In other words, we didn't have the Lord's Supper and the song and so forth in the same exact order that we'd had it in the congregation, and it bothered me. I didn't know if that was right. Now, you have to understand where I was. But I looked at that, and what I had decided was the way we did it must be the right way, so any veer away from that wasn't right. It was as if, though, I maybe thought somewhere in the New Testament, I hadn't run across it yet, but somewhere in there probably was a list of the order that you did things. Well, obviously that's not right. But it's that kind of thought. Somebody says it's the way we've always done it. Well, that doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it the only, might be a good way to do something, but it doesn't make it the right way. By the same token, it's not right simply because a person says, well, everybody else is doing so, and so let's change and do it a new way and kind of join what other people are doing. That's what really happened if you study it. That's why churches 200 years ago, two, now not 1,000, but 200 years ago, churches all across the board were absolutely against instrumental music. Nobody did instrumental music. Everybody had a cappella. And little by little, it was introduced. And in about 50 years, every denomination, including in some places like 90% of the church in Kentucky, the Lord's Church, adopted instrumental music. It took that little amount of time, but what was happening was it was the same spirit as you find in the Old Testament. Everybody else has got a king. Let's get one too. And so people adopt things just because everybody else is doing it. Somebody sees it, it seems good. Now the Bible would have us to understand that there is, for example, like in Jeremiah, you see on your outline, Jeremiah 6 and verse 16, God says, ask for the old paths. Something is old, and when it's old because God gave it to us, it's always right. And it is never right to change it. If God has commanded it, it's always right. It may not be new, it may be old, but it's exactly what we need to be doing. We can think of any number of things, you know, such as immersion for baptism or the Lord's Supper, or any number of things you want to talk about, or singing for that matter. It's old. It's 2,000 years old, but it's right because it's the path that was laid out by God. It's like Paul saying, if you'll turn to 2 Thessalonians 3 and down in verse 6, now we command you, brethren, in the name or by the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly, and notice what he says, and not after the tradition which he received of us. Tradition become almost in our day a dirty word. If it's something that's done by tradition, it's out of date, it's out of fashion, and we need to change it. Well, rather, God would say, I mean, the word tradition means something handed down. If it's been handed down by Christ to the apostles, and through them to us, is what we have to do. It's what we must do. And we're not at liberty to change that. It never goes out of fashion, and it is never time to, you know, modernize, so to speak, that practice. Now, by the same token, I want you to, you know, think about that idea, but turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 with me. There is also very present in the New Testament this idea. God has governed us in many respects. And if you stop and think about what we did today and what we are currently doing right now as a matter of worship, a person might say, why do you do what you do? You and I could find biblical passages, Bible verses, I believe at least, to support everything we've done this day. Everything we've done in here as a body, as a collective group, I believe you can find that in the Bible. However, there are many things we've done today that we've chosen either individually or we've chosen even as a group of people because God allowed us to choose that. When did we have the Lord's Supper this morning? We chose at a certain time to have that. What songs were, you know, did we sing today? Kenny chose that for us. There are a lot of choices, selections that have been made that God has allowed us to make. Now look with me, if you will, at 1 Corinthians 10 and listen to something Paul said. Conscience, he said, and I'm reading right in the middle of a context, but the point will be made. Conscience, he said, I say, not your own, but of the other. Now let me ask a question. For why is my liberty judged of another man's conscience? In Christianity, there are some very definite commandments. Brethren, if we handed these down, if we gave the tradition of these things to be done, you command that those things be done. You don't veer away from them. And if brethren began to walk disorderly and disobey them, you withdraw yourselves from those people. By the same token, the same apostle said, there are plenty of things that you can choose as an individual to do, and you have that choice to do them. And you're not to be judged. You shouldn't be judged. You don't have to be judged by another person's conscience. Now, let me stay with this point, and then I'll close with this and move on to the next point. But one important thing, it's hard for people to understand, at least in the 35 years I've been preaching, it's been something I've observed in people, that it's very difficult in many people to separate what is a matter of a collective command from what is a personal liberty. Or even, if not a personal liberty, you might say there is a third category, a personal obedience or an individual obedience to God's commands. Now let me give you a difference of those three because it's very important. What is a collective command? What is something that we have to do as obedience to a commandment of God as a group. And we can't veer away from that. We'll take the Lord's Supper, for example. And let's use that as an example. When we take the Lord's Supper, we have unleavened bread, we have fruit of the vine. Why? Because God commands it. I'm not going to take the time, but we could find the verses that show that. We take that, and we won't allow anything else. And none of us as individuals would allow someone to change that. If we came in here on Sunday morning, someone had taken it upon themselves to change the unleavened bread to just say leavened bread. Or change the fruit of the vine to, you know, Coca-Cola. If someone had done that, we would object. And we would insist on finding some grape juice and some unleavened bread very quickly to replace it so we could take the Lord's Supper. Now, someone might say, well, I just don't think you have to take unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. We'd certainly study with them, but in the end, if a brother was trying to insist on doing that, we would not allow it. We couldn't. And in fact, we'd have to obey the command if it reached that point of withdrawing from that individual. As a collective, we have to do that. There's no choice. There's no room for personal liberty, etc. Now, let's go further with that. While we take the Lord's Supper, and the supper comes to me, I have a number of things that are a matter, is a matter of my personal obedience to that command. What I think about, you'll never know that. You'll never know if I'm focusing my attention on that or I'm not. That's something I have to do as an individual while we collectively do this. We understand that. And there are plenty of things that are matters of individual faith. Well, they're not, for example, a man sits there with his hat on his head, or a woman demands that she wear a covering, or whatever. Those are things that are individual matters. I can sit next to an individual. The person sitting next to me can make those choices, and it doesn't affect me one way or the other. You see, putting Coca-Cola in the tray and me taking Coca-Cola instead of fruit of the vine affects me. But whether or not the individual focuses on the death and on the body and the blood, or even whether or not a man wears a hat sitting there, I might not like it. But it's a matter of individual faith. On the other hand, there are plenty of things that are purely matters of liberty. I mean, purely things that God has not commanded one way or the other. Some brethren have not understood this. We use, and I like the fact we do, use individual containers. So I get that little cup and you get that little cup. I don't like drinking after people. I don't want to drink after people. But I have been somewhere, Haiti in particular, where they didn't have a lot of money. And they couldn't afford those things. And when we had the Lord's Supper there, they brought out a hodgepodge of 4 to 6 regular drinking glasses or what are plastic cups. And they were filled with grape juice and we passed it around and drank from it. It's a liberty. God doesn't say one thing about that one way or the other. Now, that's important for us to understand that. It's important. It affects all of the rest of the things we're going to talk about tonight. So let's move to the second category. People began to object to their lives being controlled by a group of people that said, you must do everything this way. This is the only color clothing you can wear. You can only have so many buttons and on and on. It was very Pharisaical. And the high church idea tends to be that way. It tends to say there's only a certain kind of song you can sing. There's only this. There's only that. It's very restrictive. It doesn't allow for any innovation whatsoever. And God has just not said that. So there was, 100 years later in this country, there was the age of the Great Awakening, or sometimes it's called the Age of Enlightenment. There was a very revolutionary spirit. 1760s and 70s, it resulted in the American Revolution, etc. But that same thought is also reflected in the church. And you see people beginning to rebel, as it were. A sort of a spiritual revolution. And it affected the thought of a lot of religious people. It was the age of revivalism. There were all of these massive spiritual revivals, camp meetings, if you've read about those, and some of them were really spectacular events. There were religious crusades going on. And, you know, a lot of new denominations, if I can get it out, developed during this time. growing out of some of those few Protestant, very high church Protestant type groups, were many new, more liberal in some people's minds, freer groups of people developing into new denominations. And that's what you began to see, especially in the late 1700s and the early 1800s. Now, a lot of times people associate with all of these camp meetings and crusades and all of that, they associate a lot of hypocrisy with that. People faking things. You'll read about camp meetings, for example, and people were trying to be more spiritual. They were getting away from the formal. There was a real free thought going on in that day. And a lot of people on the outside, so to speak, observing and reporting on it, began to note what they considered hypocrisy. People getting the Holy Spirit is the way that my family would put it. But the idea of the Holy Spirit coming upon people, and there was all of this, you know, fainting and barking like a dog, and I mean that literally, and all of these various ways that people began to demonstrate that kind of spirituality. And there was a lot of emotional fervor, and people, as they reported on it, began to report on what seemed to them to be the fake, the hypocritical, etc. And growing out of that came a group of very popular preachers. This was the first time in this country that this country recognized some really almost rock star type preachers. And these preachers would go around, and the reason they were so popular is because they could stir up the people. And so you get these Elmer Gantry, and some of you are familiar with that movie. You get these Elmer Gantry type people, and they're stirring up the people, and the people are all involved in that. And here you have the high church over here that's condemning every bit of that. And there's the rebellion against that. There's the revolution against that. We don't want all of that anymore. We're a new group of people. We're a new society. We're a free society. And again, what was going on politically was transferring over into the religious. Now, we might look at that, and I think we might see a positive and a negative. It's never good to do anything spiritually because you're getting caught up in the moment. For example, if we had a very stirring sermon, let's say somebody came down front to obey the gospel, and somebody else, you know, kind of said, well, if they're going to do it, I'm going to do it, and then kind of a herd of people came down. And if we talk to them later, what we find out is the first individual was really responding, but maybe the second, third, fourth, or the seventh, eighth, and ninth, or whatever it might be. And I've seen this happen a couple of times. They were just kind of doing it because they were caught up in the moment. They were doing it because everybody else was doing it. That's not the reason to obey the gospel, and we don't want that. We want a person to respond to the gospel and obey because they believe it's what God is commanding them to do. On the other hand, it's not all bad. The idea of getting excited about your religion, the idea of wanting to be personally and spiritually, I mean your own inward spirit, involved in the religion, rather than just going through the motions of some formal rite, is in fact what God would have you to do. When we look in the Bible, I think you can see that this very attitude, and I'm not going to take the time to look at it, but I put a passage in here from Acts 13, you really see the camp type, the camp meeting, or the whole city turning out for Paul and Barnabas there. Paul's preaching in Acts 13. A lot of people getting caught up in that. But Paul took the opportunity to teach them. And a number of people obeyed the gospel. I've said to people before, you know, you can go back to the camp meetings of the early 1800s and never forget that it was out of those camp meetings that many people we would term brethren grew out of those groups. There were people that came together in the camp meetings because they were so dissatisfied with the high church formalism, they were looking for something new, but these were people who were really looking for the truth. And so people like Barton W. Stone and Alexander Campbell and John Johnson and Raccoon John Smith and these people in this country really were looking for the truth. And they found it. And they began to search the scriptures and do things as they found them, the way God teaches us to do them. And so you have, you know, in Cane Ridge, Kentucky, you have this great camp meeting in 1802. But out of that, you have a group of brethren, you have five preachers there, and then a group of brethren with them that began to go to the Scriptures and say, you know, if we're going to rebel, so to speak, let's go all the way, go back to the Bible, and just do what the Bible says. Now, that's the spirit that will lead to people obeying the gospel. So when we look at people that are, you know, we find people in the world that sort of have that same spirit. I'm not satisfied. I don't want to just go along with the crowd. I don't want to just do things the way they've always been done. I want to know what is right. When you find a person that's looking for what is right, well, that's right. That's exactly what you want in someone. Now, again, what developed were many denominations. The Lord's church grew, and that's great. But you also had the development of denominations throughout the 1800s especially. I realize they existed before, but it was the 1800s where they blossomed. It was the 1800s where a lot of the mainline denominations that you see today, I see today, really developed. Where they really took on their character. And I mean the Baptist, the Methodist, and on down the line we could go. Those denominations were developing. And what happened is, by the time you got to the 20th century, the 1900s, people had drawn the lines. They were taught to be very loyal to basically the church of their choice. They were loyal to it, and they began to contend for it. And there grew this idea, this my church. Now I want you to think about it for a moment. This nation started with a group of people looking for something. Many groups of people looking for something. They came to this country and found it. They rebelled. They weren't satisfied with what had always been. And so they had a revolution, politically and then spiritually at the same time. And then, as they formed these new groups, and as those groups were formed, even as the country was formed, what did you get? You got the my country loyalty. You got the development of thought in this country where it was no longer the new thing you were fighting for, or let's just go back and say searching for and then fighting for. Now it was yours. It's my country. My country 'tis of thee, etc. And there began to develop that very patriotic feeling in this country of the United States is the best, America is the greatest, and it's my country. Now, there was, and you have to understand, let's go back to the 1900s and you really see it. You might not see it today, but you did then. My country. You go back and study the history, the way that this country turned out for World War II, and it's incredible. We didn't just go to war, son. We didn't just have an army that went to war. We had a nation, grandma to grandchild, that went to war. They were patriotic. But you see it in the church as well. It was my church, my denomination. What was strange, and what is strange to me, is that there was a growing sentiment of allowing everybody else to have their church. So it was this, we're all in it together thing. You know, it doesn't matter how you get to heaven, as long as we all go, as long as we're all united behind Jesus. But personally, individually, my church. The loyalty to my church. Now think about what happens there. Young people, especially after World War II, began to notice that what you were having in people was a loyalty to the church. I want you to be turning to Romans 2. A loyalty to the church, an identity even, if you will. I am a Baptist. I am a Lutheran. I am a Methodist, etc. That's my church. You had that loyalty to a denomination, but very little emphasis and lessening all the time on actually living it. And to this, Paul would say, I believe, in Romans chapter 2, if you look at it, and you start in verse 17, he says, you are called a Jew. Now, we could put any number of things in there. We could say, you are called a Baptist. You are called a Lutheran. Or let's just bring it closer to home. You are called a Christian. Behold, you are called a Jew, and you rest in the law. That is, you rest upon it. You take confidence in it. That's your basis, etc. And you make your boast of God. And you know His will and approve the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law. Now, notice the denomination. It has its creed. Many times it has its local church articles. It has its articles of faith, etc.
When I went to seminary, they taught us, any church you went into, if they didn't have this, you developed it. You wanted people to sign it, like a contract. You wanted people to adhere to it and be loyal to it, was the idea. Well, listen to what Paul is saying. You're confident of these things. Verse 19, you're confident that you yourself are a guide of the blind, a light of them which are in darkness. You're an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babies. He goes on and on with that. But what's the problem? What Paul is saying is the problem is you don't live it. You claim to have the best. It's the church of my choice. I choose to be a Baptist because the Baptists, I believe, are superior. They're the best. It doesn't mean that I won't accept the Methodist or I don't think he's going to heaven, but my way really is the best, and that's why I've chosen it. It was that loyalty. I see that same sentiment in the Lord's church, and it's dead wrong. We're not members of the Church of Christ because it's just another denomination, but we think it's the best. If that's why you're doing something, if your loyalty is to the Church of Christ, if you wear the name Church of Christ, if your language is, I am Church of Christ, and I rest upon that, I take my confidence in that, you've missed it. Paul goes on to say here, God goes on to say here, read this together with me. Drop down to verse 27. Shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, if it fulfill the law, judge you? What does he say? There can be a Baptist out there, and he's a Baptist, but on some point of the truth, he understands it. He gets it. And the truth is, he does it much better than I do. He judges me. Because on that point of truth, he's got it right, and I don't. And what God is saying is, you may have someone out there who's not even a Christian. This is what Paul was trying to teach the Jews. You could have a Gentile out there who by nature obeyed God's law. And so he judges you. Notice as he goes on to say, who by the letter and circumcision do transgress the law. He says in verse 28, he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly. And you can put anything in there. You are not a Jew, a Christian, a Baptist, or anything else, just because you wear the name. Just because you attend the building where those people go. He is not a Christian who's one outwardly, and he is not a Jew who's one outwardly. Neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew. He is a Christian which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. Young people began to react against their parents, their grandparents, the people around them, who wore a name of a particular denomination, who in an argument over the bridge table might argue for the superiority of their denomination, but they weren't living Christian lives. There just wasn't anything spiritual about them. They were hypocrites. And so there began to be this cry out against that. If you're going to be a Christian, live it. It's far more important to live the Christian life than it is to be loyal to the church of your choice. I don't think they're wrong in that. So there was, as a reaction against that, there was the age of the charismatic movement. I really came in during this time, and I think a lot of you my age and younger, you can relate to this. What I saw in people my age in high school, if they were spiritual people, they just didn't really care what you were, at least by name or label. But what they really wanted to know was, how fired up are you about whatever you do? There was that charisma, that excitement, etc. The charismatic movement. And it developed all across denominational lines. And people began to see, churches began to see, especially young people, pulling away, joining in what were informal groups. They would join together at somebody's house. They may sit out in a field somewhere around a campfire or whatever. But they were pulling away and they were striving for the inward. Now, unfortunately, you know, we might look at that and say, well, they went too far. You know, when you had all of the Godspell and Jesus freaks and Jesus Christ superstar, and there was no emphasis on doctrine, no emphasis on law, just in your heart, do you feel it?
They went too far.
Well, I agree with that. Because as Jesus says in John 4, in verse 23 and 24, worship has to be in spirit, yes, but also in truth. There has to be a balance there. I don't want the high church formalism where we just, by manner of right, somebody stands up and reads something and we read out of a book, we read the words. Don't even think about it. We just kind of go along with it. Or somebody proclaims something over me, the last rites or whatever, and that's good enough. I don't want that. And I don't think that's what God commands. But by the same token, I don't want to go to the other extreme where I say law and doctrine doesn't matter as long as you feel good about it. No, it does matter. We have to understand that God commands. We still go back to what we started with. There are those things handed down by Jesus through the apostles, and we're commanded to do those things. I think it's this rivalism between the two thoughts, this extreme that people get into. They're either all the way over here and they're wearing a label, but it doesn't mean anything. Or they're all the way over here and they feel great about what they're doing. They just don't have a clue about what they're doing. I think it's all of that that leads to what I'll say and what a lot of you in the 80s and 90s especially witnessed. And that was the age of just disillusionment. If you look at the graphics, the statistics in this country, church membership in the 80s especially plummeted. The 70s was the last heyday. The charismatic movement was the last heyday of religion in this country. Since the 80s, it's gone down. Now, there's been a little bit of a resurgence, and I'm encouraged by that. But the 80s saw it plummet. People were disillusioned. Talked to young people, fed up with all that. Had enough of all of that. I don't care. You want to talk about the Jesus freaks, or you want to talk about the most formal religion, I don't want any part of it. And so people in the 80s, you know, Ronald Reagan came into the presidency and everybody got fired up in the country about the resurging economy. If you remember, those of you that follow such things, the Dow had languished for 14, 15 years, whatever it was, around the same, all the time I was in school. It just never changed. We used to laugh about it. Where is it today? And you look at them, yeah, okay, where is it today? It hadn't moved. Didn't move the whole time I went from 7th grade to 12th grade. I don't think it moved 5 points. Now, that's an exaggeration. But man, the 80s. Boom! And business. Boom! And people got caught up in that. The new religion began to be make money. Make more money. And people just got all caught up in that. They were disillusioned with religion. They pursued their own self-interest, etc., etc. And that led to where we are today. If I go out here and talk to people today, what do I find? I find people in every phase of what I remember, what I've listed tonight, every single phase. Some are still in the high church. Some are still in a charismatic group. Some are totally disillusioned, a lot of people. And you know what happens is you can pursue the dollar in business and all of that kind of thing, and you're going to be left empty. There's just something missing. And why is that? I want you to turn to Ecclesiastes with me and read a passage. Wes and I were studying with someone a couple of weeks ago. I don't know exactly Wes, but it seemed like it was a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about this very thing. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and down in verse 13, we were talking with the young guy and we said, you know, the reason you feel like you do is because if you're not worshiping God, you're not serving God, you're not a Christian. There is something missing. You were created. I was created to be a religious person, to be a spiritual person. If you look at the way Solomon said it, he said it like this in verse 13, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. I know that most translations put the whole duty, but if you'll notice, duty is in italics. It just literally says this is the whole of man. You know what it's saying? Fearing God and keeping His commandments, really, when it comes down to it, is all we are. And if you're not doing that, then you've got less in your life than you're supposed to have. And you feel it. That's why you see you hear people saying, something is missing. We want to reach out to those people and help them to understand that. That what's missing is obeying God. That is really a fulfilled life when you obey God and you respect Him as God. Now, I realize there are also a lot of people in churches, mega church we talked about a couple of weeks ago. I won't re-preach all of that. They're looking for something. They want something that can help them because that's the way they've grown up in the 80s and 90s. It's been very selfish. Go out here and find what serves me. And they've transferred that to church. And the mega church, it jumps out as I can have church and I can get a lot out of it. So that seems great. But you're going to find a lot of people that are, they may be busy in a mega church and being able to do a lot, they're still not fulfilled spiritually. And that's where we can help. I'm going to close, but the lesson tonight is about where people are and understanding why they are where they are and understanding really the superiority of what we have to offer. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, if you come to Jesus tonight, I can't promise you that it's going to be an easy road ahead for you, that everything's going to work out in your life just perfectly and there'll never be another problem or anything like that. That's not Christianity. But I can tell you that what God would tell you is this. As you fear God, as you respect Him, as you obey Him, your life will be fulfilled. If you confess your belief in Jesus, you're willing to repent, you'll be baptized for forgiveness of your sins, you will know you are where you're supposed to be. If you continue growing in Jesus Christ, you will always feel good about it. Maybe you're here tonight and you know that your life hasn't been on the course it needs to be. You might have been baptized, but it's just not where it needs to be. Come back to the Lord. And won't you please come while we stand and sing.